Hi, this is Manton Reese.
And this is Daniel Jalpin.
And this is Core Intuition. Only the rich can have robots. This episode is sponsored by OmniFocus 3 and Linode. Well, Daniel, WWDC is just around the corner, really just a few weeks. But before that happens, there are other tech companies, you know, that have conferences. And Microsoft billed their conferences this week. And Google I.O. was this week, too. And so I don't pay that close attention. Like, I don't watch them live. Usually I have other stuff to do. But I do look at, like, little recaps, and I'll poke in on some of the news. And a couple things really stood out for me at these conferences that I think are relevant to us. And the big one, I've just got to say, you know, if listeners haven't seen it yet, we'll link in the show notes. Daniel, I don't know if you had a chance to see it yet, but in the Google conference, they showed a new feature of Google Assistant called Duplex that can make calls for you. My mind is completely blown by this. I think this is the most impressive tech demo I've seen probably in, like, I don't know, since the first iPhone, maybe. It's absolutely mind-blowing, and I don't even know what to think about it.
You know, if it's funny, in typical fashion, well, first of all, I'll just say, I love it when these other big companies have a conference, because, like you, I don't really follow it carefully. I have, over the years, seen one or two. Like, I remember a couple of years ago, I think I saw the one where the Surface was announced from Microsoft. But it's usually, like, last minute, somebody's like, I see somebody on Twitter or micro.blog for that matter, who says, like, hey, this is interesting. This is going to be a keynote going on. And I'm like, oh, it's like, that's 5 minutes from now. I'm going to watch that. Whereas it's kind of funny for me to get the reality check about how most of the world sees Apple's WWDC stuff, where, you know, you and I and almost all of our listeners are like, since like 6 months ago, or like, well, what do you think? We'll be in San Jose again. What are they going to do? Are they going to announce? Is it going to be Marzipan? Are they going to be this and that and the other thing? And then, like, come on, it's March. When are they going to announce it? Well, they don't usually do it until April. Oh, sometimes it's been May. Oh, well, they announced it. It's in San Jose. Everybody have their hotel rooms? Yeah, I've already got mine. I booked mine 6 months ago, dummy. And then it's like, you know, and then, like, Google is like, oh, Google had an event. I missed it.
Yeah, and exactly. I know, like the day before, not months in advance.
So anyway, I just I like that about these events, that they sort of help orient my extreme bias towards Apple news, because I'm sure there are people who have been doing the same thing we do for WWDC, but for the Google event in particular, and I probably to a lesser extent, but still a significant extent, to the Microsoft event. And I also like about how these have, at least it seems like in recent years, these have been coming up before WWDC, so they're kind of like set a little bit of a stage for, like, what's Apple going to do to one up this or match it, or you know with the Surface. I remember that was a particularly well timed one, because I think that was the year that Apple came out with the Touch Bar, and it kind of felt vaguely like a response to that, but of course it wasn't. It was in development for years,
right.
But anyway, to answer your question, I didn't really get a chance to look at this news. Maybe also in typical Daniel fashion, my main exposure to this has been through social media quips about...
You get all your news through jokes on
I get social media. That's true. If it's not a joke on social media, I'm not interested. But, you know, there's been some great, like, you know, can't wait to hear how Google AI reacts to my wife getting its first phone call from me via it, you know.
And it's not clear to me how flexible this is. Like, the examples they used are, like, have the assistant, you know, book a haircut appointment for you, reserve a restaurant or, you know, hotel, or different things like that, where you're calling a business, you're asking for hours or a reservation or something like that. I don't think you can tell it to, like, call your wife and have a conversation, right? It's fairly narrow. But it's just so impressive. And if you think about the things we've been talking about, and just to summarize what it can do, you tell it, like, I want a haircut appointment on, you know, next Friday between, you know, noon and two or something like that. And it actually calls the place and, like, goes back and forth and has a conversation. Oh, no, you don't have anything at two. What about appointment at one? Like, and it's really, like I said, it's mind blowing. I'm extremely impressed by it. But in the context of the things we were talking about and with WWDC coming up, like a thing that I keep repeating over and over is that like Apple has dropped the ball, and specifically I love, you know, my Echo, and I think Amazon is ahead. You know, meanwhile, Google's doing all this stuff, and they're just like, it seems like they're just playing a completely different game. And Apple, of course, they have things they're working on, but WWDC is in 2 weeks. They're not going to change anything. They're not going to like work on new AI in the next 2 weeks to try to one-up Google. So like whatever they have is what they have. I don't know what they have, I guess is the takeaway from this, but I will be shocked if Apple is even remotely close to what Google is doing. And you know, we can have a separate conversation about whether this is good, this feature is any good, because like, do we really want to live the rest of our life talking to robots? I don't know.
Right.
But you can't deny that it's an incredible technical achievement, and that it will also improve many, many other things in terms of talking to these home devices, just ourselves.
I mean, yeah, it sounds amazing. I have to concede, it sounds like the level of AI experimentation and execution that other companies besides Apple do try to do more. Now, I would say also that a lot of other companies try to do these things and then fail. But if the demo is as impressive as you described, maybe this is a breakthrough. I have a couple thoughts on it. First of all, I also think aesthetically, and maybe culturally, maybe socially, I don't think this is the kind of thing Apple would do, partly because of what you're alluding to, like the "do we want to talk to robots" thing, which might sound a little weird when obviously Apple has Siri and it's essentially, you know, a feature that allows people to talk to robots. But socially, I think it is weird to impose your robot on other people.
Yeah. The difference is you don't, when you're talking to Siri, you know you're talking to a robot. When your robot calls a restaurant, they don't know. And if you listen to these demos, and you have to listen to these demos, like everybody listening, if you haven't seen these, and Daniel, after we talk, you have to listen to these. They're that impressive. But the Google assistant has, I think, 6 different voices now. Some of them are better than others, but some of them you just can't tell it's not a human. Like, and they even introduce these kind of like quirks of human, you know, English talking in particular, like where you say like do you have an appointment for 2 p.m. to, you know, and you're fooled. I'm telling you, like, so, if one of these called you, you might think it was a little weird, but you would not be able to tell, at least in these examples, that you were talking to a computer.
So here's my first thought. So it's funny because I'm one of these people, like I'm sure many of our listeners, who is sort of like somewhere between not interested and terrified of making phone calls.
Yeah, right. That's the thing, right?
And on the one hand, I'm thinking like this could be really great for me, but I also have a sort of like earnestness and like, I do sort of like rage against the robot machine, you know, mentality a little bit. Like I like the idea that we maintain human interactions, legitimate, bona fide human interactions. Even if I'm the person who's always like, "Ooh, this pizza place lets you order online, so I'm going to choose them over the place that makes you make a phone call." So it's a little bit, I admit it's a little bit like, I mean, I'm sitting here saying like, no, we need to keep human interaction alive. And at the same time, I'm like, what can I do to possibly limit my human interaction?
And the cold calling human interaction is the worst one, I think, for most of us, right? It's different when you're like talking to someone at the counter at the pizza place versus having to call someone and like explain everything.
It is. But even then I'm like, you know, I'm the kind of person who's like, who like frets over going into a kind of business that I've never been into before, because I'm like, what if they ask me what I want and I don't know what I want? Right. And, you know, I just overthink this stuff. And certainly Google Duplex is not going to overthink this. It's going to just be like, well, let me see. but like there's a couple angles to, I think my mind has like already like divided my thoughts about this into 3 distinct groups. It's the hell no, that's dehumanizing. I'm posing robots on other people, making other people contend with my kind of like, there's also a class issue here where it's like, well, if you're high enough class and rich enough, you can have your robots do your work for you. But if you're, you know, poor or not sophisticated, then you have to do the grunt work and like actually make a phone call or be the one that answers the phone call. There's a little bit of an angle of that for me. Hmm. Then there's the like, oh, wouldn't it be nice if I never had to deal with making a phone call again? And that's that like middle angle where I really kind of like feel like, you know, I like the human interaction in theory, but if I could say, Google, take care of scheduling a plumber for me, maybe I would just like it if a plumber happened, you mm-hmm. know? But then, and at the far other end of the spectrum, I think, is the serious accessibility win this can be for people who right. can't make phone calls.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
And, you know, there's like TDD is like the, I think, the predecessor to this. I'm a little out of date. There probably already are better solutions for people, for instance, who can't speak or can't hear. Or can't speak or hear well. But if this works the way you describe, then you can have a sort of reaction to it like I have, which is like dismissive or like, bleh, like that's not humane or somewhere in the middle. But then I think it also warrants a reaction of like, oh, wow, this is an unabashed breakthrough for accessibility purposes, particularly if it's as open as it. What's the deal with it, Manton? Is it like, anybody who has Google
I think
account?
It's, yeah, mm-hmm. I think it's just an Android or mm-hmm. Google Assistant feature. I didn't catch if it was part of the new Android P release or if it's still experimental. It looked like it was at least in, you know, kind of beta ready stage. I don't know. It didn't look like it was far off. It looked mm-hmm. like it was kind of working now, but I did miss that part. I assume that when it's actually out and people can use it, it'll be, you know, anybody can use it. Like your point about like only the rich can have robots. I think this is actually a counter argument to that. I mean, I think that more and more people will have smartphones over time. You know, obviously mm-hmm. we've already seen that. And I feel like this is one of those technologies that is not exclusively to the rich. You know, it basically will be free to anybody that has access to Google Assistant, has a smartphone, has a Google account. So it's not like you have to pay, you know, $10,000 to get the Google Assistant that can make appointments for you. So you're right, though. This is a complex issue. I mean, there are a lot of things to kind of mm-hmm. think about through this. And it's a breakthrough for technology, I think. And there's certainly some wins, like you said, for accessibility. And I also think, like, the future is not just robots calling and making appointments, because you can imagine, like, if I say I want to book a restaurant next Tuesday for three people, the Google Assistant should be able to see if that restaurant supports like OpenTable or something like that, and then just like automatically make the reservation without calling, right? Like, it feels like this calling is kind mm-hmm. of it's a fallback when there is no automated way to do things that, let's be honest, should be automated. You should not have to talk to someone to make a hotel, you know, to make a restaurant reservation, right? But the fact is, like, that's the lowest common denominator. Like, for a lot of businesses, you do have to pick up the phone. So I don't think that robots are going to be calling humans all the time in the future, mm-hmm. but maybe this is it's a stopgap. And also, it's, like I said, I think it's like a training ground for being able to talk to our devices more. Like, I imagine that Google is going to learn some things about this back and forth conversational aspect to Google Assistant that would apply to just asking it to play music and then having a conversation about like the music you wanted to play because it got it wrong.
Right. And as with all things Google, of course, there's, you know, you said it probably will be free, but then probably the trade-off is when I ask Google to make a reservation at Mexican restaurant, and suddenly I'll start getting Mexican restaurant ads
right
everywhere I go.
Yeah, and it'll know like where you eat, and it'll have way too much information about you. That's absolutely part of this whole trade-off that some people might not be comfortable with, which is totally fine. But I don't think, especially as Apple fans, I don't think we can just dismiss this or say like Apple wouldn't do it or it's bad as like a defensive, like, you know, it's not on our platform, so we don't like it or something. Like, I do think it's incredible. And I hope I haven't oversold it. I don't think I have, actually.
No. Well, it sounds like, you know, like I said, I'm sorry, I haven't had a chance to check the demos myself, but it sounds like from what I've seen, press and just like everyday online reaction to it, it sounds like it was one of those things that exceeded people's expectations. And that's what we kind of what we live for as techies, you know, right. Like we're Apple fans, a lot of us. But, and so ideally we want to see, wow, you know, mind boggling stuff that comes from, or is at least, you know, sort of oriented around an Apple platform, you know, approach. But at the end of the day, it's like, hey, speaking of that Microsoft Surface thing, like when Microsoft did that, a lot of people in the Mac world were like, hey, where's our iMac that can do that? You know, like we're not dumb when it comes to like, hey, if you do something really smart and really groundbreaking, we want a piece of that. And I think this is an example that underscores your argument that you've been having with me for a long time, which is that Siri is way far behind and maybe too far behind to catch up. I'm not going to completely write off Apple having like a savvy, like, you know, Skunk Works plan for Siri that we haven't seen yet. I hope that happens, but it's going to be very interesting, this WWDC. I think you alluded to this, like if they, in a previous show, if they come into this WWDC and are just like, good news, we have two more intents, mm-hmm. you know, yep. Now you can order ice cream and, you know, now you can order ice cream and you can, I don't know, what else would you even do? Check, when's your trash delivery? You know, I don't know. Something like a couple like kind of modest things. And they don't have anything, you know, like we were saying earlier, anything Apple has been working on has been in the works for years, at least probably years. And if not, then at least several months. Mm-hmm. What they can show at WWDC, what they can show is not instructed by what these other companies show, but what they choose to show and how they choose to spin it can be. And like, I think, you know, like for instance, they could have like some side project going where it's like, yeah, that's not really ready for WWDC. And then I'm not saying this is going to happen, but in some scenarios, there could be situations where another company announces something and it pushes Apple to say, you know what? We got to show that now. Mm-hmm. We got to say we're in this game. And I don't know if they are in this game. I kind of doubt they're in this particular game, but hopefully they're in some game that makes it so that their reaction to, for instance, this Google Duplex announcement isn't, hey, HomePod can recognize two voices mm-hmm. now.
It can set two timers,
right? Or set two timers. You know, we're all expecting some news about Siri. I mean, there has to be some news, right?
We're working on something for right. the last year, right?
So now the question is, what is the news, and how can it be spun in a way that sounds least pathetic compared to what the other guys have been doing?
We're setting our expectations pretty low here. And that, yeah, I think that, good, right? that says a lot. But yeah, and I could see Apple doing the opposite too, where like if they have something that's kind of similar to what Google's doing, but obviously not as good, maybe they just cut it from the keynote and focus on something else, right? Because mm-hmm. what they show, they want to impress people. Like they need to play to their strengths and like the good stuff they have. I'm sure they have good stuff, right? There's always something good at WWDC. So I could see them taking kind of both approaches where if they have something that's similar but not quite ready, maybe they hint at it. Or if they have something similar but that's not as good, maybe they just kind of like cut it for now and focus yeah. on the stuff that really does shine. I kind of keep coming back to, you know, I've mentioned this before in the show, that Knowledge Navigator concept video from Apple in the late 80s when John Sculley was CEO, and like this idea that you could talk to your Mac and it would make appointments for you and pull up your emails and help you with things. Mm-hmm. Like, it's been 30 years since that video. In some ways, like we saw like a hint of this with the original Siri and certainly with the Echo, But I think right now, with everything that's been happening and with this new Google stuff, we are really close. Like, you can see now where we might actually be able to do the stuff that was in that video 30 years ago. Like, we're really on the, like, we're kind of skirting on the edge of this now, where it's like, you can see that it's kind of within reach, some of that stuff that was really far out there. And that's cool. I don't know, that's cool. I mean, like, we can talk about the ethical side and just like the human, you know, robot communication and all that kind of thing. But like, I think that's a neat place to be, to actually be on the verge of having some of this capability where you have digital assistants that do stuff for you and help you.
Right, right. Yeah, and I mean, the bottom line is, if that stuff turns out to be fundamental to the future of computing, then even if Apple's way behind right now, they're going to end up getting the wake-up call if they haven't already gotten it. And they're going to end up, you know, the one advantage Apple has is they have all the money in the world.
This is true.
It's like, so it's like, it doesn't guarantee contention in technical races, but it does mean that if Apple got its priorities right and decided, you know, this is where the future is, let's go there, let's go to that place, they can be a, you know, they like, I have a feeling that this stuff, a lot of people like to talk about stuff like this as like one company or two companies being like so far ahead that nobody can catch up. And I think there's some truth to that, but then I also think there's sort of a commoditization over time that is on a longer scale than we wish it was, but like probably 10 years from now, whatever Google is doing right now is going to be commoditized to the point where everybody's doing it, you know, kind of like, you know, I think probably to some extent things like image mm-hmm. recognition right. is that way now. And you know, it's just going to be to the point where it's like, okay, everybody can do that. And, but it's obviously it's going to be a benefit. Google will be somewhere else then, I guess, is the point. But,
well, yeah, I mean, I don't disagree. I think that there can be certain companies that lead the way on certain aspects of this, but then eventually kind of everybody has it, and that's fine. I think there's another route that Apple could take with this too, and something that I blogged about maybe a year ago or maybe 2 years even, about the fact that we have these kind of closed assistants, and you know, you got the Echo, you got the Google Assistant, you got the Siri, you got, you know, it's like they're all like siloed off. And if Apple can't compete exactly with what Google's doing, or doesn't want to compete with it, the other thing they can do is they can open up Siri. And I think they should do this regardless of whether they're competitive, but that's kind of like an escape hatch. Open it up, mm-hmm. let anybody build things for it, including Google. Like, why wouldn't Google want their assistant as part of Siri? And I think that would, it'd be better for users. There would be more power and flexibility in these devices. I think it would just be a win overall, but I think it would also give Apple kind of a way out if they just are not focused enough on this AI stuff to keep up with everybody mm-hmm. else. They could still have a platform, open it up, let other people build stuff for it, and then who knows what will happen.
I think that's a good point. You know, and they have those advantages of having a ton of money and a ton of passionate users. The time to make that choice is probably before it's too late, right? Mm-hmm. So that the earlier they, if that is their way out, then the earlier they made that choice, the better probably for that outcome. But well, it remains to be seen. I don't know what they've got up their sleeve, but
yeah,
hopefully it's better than ice cream delivery, whatever.
Yeah, if they do ice cream delivery and they give everybody WWC ice cream, that'll go over pretty well.
That'll go over pretty well for a day or two.
Reach under your chair. There's free ice cream.
You get an ice cream. You get an ice cream.
It's a little melted, but
All right, folks, back sponsoring the show this week, our friends at Omni, and they would like us to remind you that OmniFocus 3 for iOS is coming soon, and it's a fresh, major update to this well-loved app from the Omni Group. New features include flexible inspectors so that OmniFocus works the way you want it to work. The forecast view now interleaves tasks and events so you can plan your days better. And most importantly, they've replaced context with tags. You can apply multiple tags to your tasks and projects where before you could apply just to one context. This opens up a powerful new world of custom perspectives and workflows. Think about combining tags for energy level, priority, location, person, and so on. Read all about this and more at Inside OmniFocus. Go to inside.omnifocus.com. Thanks to Omni for sponsoring the show.
Yeah, of course, I've been using OmniFocus. I have it here on my Mac, use it every day, going through stuff that I need to be working on. And the new iOS version, they're really excited about it. This has been going in beta for a while now. And I just noticed on the blog, on the Omni Group blog, they have that Inside OmniFocus site, which is great. And they also have the blog. Brent Simmons has been posting to the Omni blog lately. And they had an update that the iOS version is shipping May 30th. So they have everything ready to go. Be on the lookout for that update. Bunch of new features. And of course, syncing between iOS and Mac. OmniFocus is a great app. Thanks so much to Omni for supporting the podcast. You can learn more again on that site, inside.omnifocus.com. So we don't want to spend the whole show necessarily on some of these other conferences, but I did want to point out from Microsoft's conference, the big thing that stood out for me there, because I'm not super into the Windows side and the enterprise side of everything Microsoft is doing. The thing that stood out for me is the change in their App Store where, you know, we're used to Apple taking 30% of sales in the App Store. I've never been a huge fan of that high of a cut. And there's frustrations that we still go through with the App Store. And I thought it was interesting that Microsoft is changing something. So for certain apps, I don't think it's games, but I think it's like certain kinds of apps that would probably be what you and I, Daniel, would be building. Now they only take a 15% cut. So you get 85% of the purchase price. And that's if someone discovers the app in the App Store, like they're clicking around and they find your app. So it's kind of like Microsoft's helping people find your app, right? It's good. You know, they deserve a cut of that. If you link directly to your app in the store, like if you have your own ad campaign or you're linking from your website or whatever, so someone goes to buy your app from you, like Microsoft isn't really helping people find your app or like bubble that up. That app up in you know, the store, they only take 5%. So you get 95%. That is how it should be, I think. I mean, I was really impressed with that because that is a huge difference. Whether someone takes 30% of your app's revenue or 5%, that adds up to a significant amount of money over time.
You know, this is one of those things where I think Apple's, if it's not broke, don't fix it. Attitude has really been hurting developers because they've obviously got, like I said earlier, all the money in the world. They have, yet nonetheless, at the same time, on the iOS App Store, they have a committed developer base who has very little incentive to ignore the App Store. You know, like it's a huge, popular, profitable outlet. So it's kind of a situation where, you know, Apple, like being a worse company, could probably raise their cut to 40%. And
ouch.
People would cry and wail about it. And you know what? They would stay in the App Store because they want to sell to iOS customers. I mean, this is like one of these situations where it's like what Apple should do is lower the rate, I think. But Apple is famous for not messing with success. And it's frustrating because a lot of us think, no, 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 Apple, you could have more success and other people around you could have more success if you just messed with success a little bit. And one of my big, like, you know, I've been following Apple for, I guess, 25 years or so. It's one of the things I've taken away from the company is if you want to understand their logic about something, it really is just standing still and doing nothing is the preferred. And I don't mean that in as denigrating a way as it sounds. It could come off that way in particular with things like, you know, how they seem to treat Siri, et cetera. But if they have the feeling that something is working the way it is, they would rather leave it the way it is than risk messing it up by changing something. And I have witnessed this even down to the point where I think I have vague memories of this being like, you know, even talked about inside the company. This is just sort of like part of the Apple. It's like part of the Apple approach that doesn't get talked a lot about outside the company, I think. But in some ways, like, you know, you can imagine how it has some really good effects. It's like, if the status quo is working, don't start collecting like private user data just in the hopes that we can capitalize on it. You know, like there's a lot of ways that doing the things the way you've always done them is an asset to Apple and it benefits customers and developers. But with that 30% cut, it's like since day one, that's been 10 years now, right? Since day one of the iOS App Store. And since day one, people have been questioning whether 30% is the right number. And I think everybody who questions it from the point of view that it might be too high. So I'm glad to see, even if I think like, one, Apple is not inclined to change without like evidence that it needs to, and two, that people wouldn't leave even if they raised the rate, I think that it's still nice to see other companies out there trying to make this at least, like nobody's going to be like, well, that settles it. I'm going to stop developing for iOS and go develop only for Microsoft. I don't even know what, you know, like, what do you sell on the Microsoft store? But
Marsa for Windows.
Yeah, right. It's a good example of making a kind of like, it's almost like throwing shade, politically throwing shade at Apple's price cut. And, you know, there is a consequence to that. And whether it will make people leave or not, it can make people more grudging of Apple. And I think any pressure that Apple can receive from the outside to say, hey, have you considered using some of your like billions of dollars to make the app ecosystem for your developers who are, you know, in turn earning you billions of dollars to just make it a little bit more rewarding for them?
Yeah. And, you know, last week we talked about the big services part of Apple's business and how it's like the second biggest thing, you know, compared to the iPhone. It makes more money than the Mac and the iPad, and that 30% is part of that. And I don't know what part of that. I don't know how huge that part is versus like Apple Music and iCloud storage and everything else. But you can imagine that Apple's so excited about that services revenue that, yeah, they don't want to change anything. And I can kind of respect like trying to be deliberate and thoughtful and not just change things. Like I've tried to have that approach with micro.blog, being very deliberate, not adding features or changing features until I'm absolutely sure, because it's hard to walk some of that stuff back. Apple is good at that usually. So I totally get that. But at the same time, that 30% really hurts.
And yeah,
they did the subscription change where like the second year after someone has been a subscriber for an auto-renewing subscription, you know, they only take 15%. Google, I believe, does the same thing now. And I think it seemed like Google just kind of wanted to match Apple, like let's make it consistent so people don't have to worry about it. And Microsoft clearly, they have the least to lose, you could say, but they clearly just want to make that platform as enticing as possible to developers, which I, you know, makes sense.
I like this. I mean, I agree with you that a lot of across the board, it seems like everyone's just saying, well, if it's working for Apple, if it's working for Google, well, 30%, I guess that's the number. And Microsoft doing this, it seems like 15%, if that had been the number from the beginning, would have garnered some criticism as also being too high. But it's certainly after all these years of paying 30%, it seems, and now the fact that like subscription-based you know, sales can reach that 15% number, it makes it feel like 15% is the number. You know, like if it's good enough for subscriptions, it's good enough for all the sales. I think all iOS and Mac developers who sell through the app stores would be very satisfied with an across the board change to 15% is Apple's cut. I mean, that would be huge. It would be huge. Yeah. And yet I haven't like run the numbers. I know Apple like spends some money on this because they, you know, it's a little bit one of these things where it's like, okay, well, my app is like 30 megabytes, but some people's apps are like 900 megabytes and we all pay the same cut. But I would be surprised if Apple didn't still break even at least on the cost of the app stores with a 15% cut. And I think, to be honest, I think Apple needs to see the app stores as they shouldn't be primarily about profit for Apple. They should be about they should be about driving the viability of the platform.
I think that too. I think I even wrote a blog post about this a few years ago. It can be kind of break even. I think that should be good enough. And again, you got to balance that because the services revenue is important to Apple, but there are a lot of ways they can make money through services. And they should be as inviting as possible to developers. And there's still so many roadblocks with, and the thing about like the size of the app, like, I don't think that's a huge factor really, especially, there's so many free apps. I would say free apps definitely make up the vast majority of download size, like in terms of bandwidth for the App Store. I don't think there's any question. It's probably like 90% or something like that.
Right.
Now, of course, a lot of those free apps have in-app purchases and are wildly successful, and Apple's taking 30% of that. But I don't think that I'm not worried about Apple's hosting costs, I guess is what I'm saying, for apps. No. I'm much more concerned about their ability to run the store well. 15% seems like that seems okay. Seems like it's fair if they help people discover apps, which I think they're doing a better job at with the iOS 11 App Store in particular. But there's still so many roadblocks. There's a brand new app that came out today as we're recording for micro.blog. It's called iCro. It's like a third-party app for micro.blog. It's like the first big one. It's really great. Like, it's, if you've checked out micro.blog before, maybe you didn't like the app that I wrote or something, definitely check out iCro. It's really, really nice app. Everyone I've heard that has tried it today or was on the beta loves it. Anyway, long story short, the reason I'm bringing this up, other than to promote the app because I think it's cool, is like he ran into all sorts of problems with app review, and then the app not showing up, and then having to talk to Apple on the phone, and then it had to be reviewed again. And it's like that 30% hurts in particular when Apple can't do their job right, which is to approve apps quickly, to make them available, discoverable to users. And you know, it was really frustrating. Like, this wasn't even my app, but because it used micro.blog, I was really excited about it. And I wrote a blog post and I was like ready to click send, like tell everyone about the app. And then like days go by and it's like you're in this kind of churn going back and forth with Apple about something, or it doesn't show up. And it's like that kind of stuff is frustrating 10 years in. Like, we shouldn't have those kind of problems. That 30% should cover Apple doing its job to approve apps quickly and get them in the store.
Yes, it certainly seems. I mean, when I look at like the number, I'm so grateful to be as, you know, I'm always striving to be more successful, but I'm grateful to be as successful as I am, that the thousands of dollars that I send, you know, inadvertently to Apple. And you're right, when I feel like, hey, throw me a bone here, like I'm trying to like be part of your viable platform here, I have sent you, I don't know how many tens of thousands of dollars.
Right. Don't calculate it. It'll depress you.
I think I did. I think I did once. A friend of the show, sort of, you know, a friend of mine, I think you know him too, Manton, Luke Vandal from Edovia. I think he tweeted at one point a little bit of frustration. He was like, I've paid Apple over $500,000.
Oh my gosh.
You know? Wow. And I was like, yeah, well, you know, that's good. It's revealing that he's had a certain amount of success. I might be wrong with that number, but that was the number that stuck in my head. I think it was like that.
It was a big number.
And it makes sense because over 10 years, if you think about it, it's like a successful software company, over 10 years, that would be $50,000 a year. And, well, wait, what is that? $50,000 a year, that would be like $150,000 a year of revenue, which is a lot of money. And believe me, everybody who's just like hoping and dreaming of making that money. And I haven't been making that money recently, at least. But that is a good amount of, that's an appropriate amount of money for a successful software company on the App Store to make. So over 10 years, you give Apple $500,000. What do they give you for it? 10-day review delays sometimes, arbitrary, like nonsensical rejections. you know, keep you out of featured lists that you should be in.
I'm still bitter about that.
And yeah, I mean, I just like, I don't know. And I don't think like there should be a special tier for people who are like, I gave you $500,000 over the last 10 years. So how about you put me in a special category that gets like its reviews done on time? But on the other hand, you know, hey, for everybody who gives the $500,000 over 10 years, spread that money out and make it work for everybody.
Mm-hmm. And the bottom line here is like, we're paying for something. Like, we're not asking for like a charity or like, you know, it's like, we don't want a handout from Apple. Like, we look up to Apple so much and we respect them so much because they do great work that sometimes it feels like we're like kneeling down and like asking their permission to do Apple. Right. Like, but come on. I mean, we pay them 30% in some cases. I don't anymore. I mean, I don't have any paid apps in the App Store, but we shouldn't have to be in the position where it's always we're asking and pleading just for them to do the job. Like, they get millions of dollars, billions of dollars, actually, in services revenue. And in turn, they should be as respectful and efficient with developers as possible. I don't think that's too much to ask.
No, not when you put it that way. No, it's not.
So, yeah, I don't know. This is, I don't think, no matter what Apple does, I don't think I'll ever stop complaining about parts of the App Store. I do try to point out when the good stuff happens. Like, I do think that the way they're doing curation and featuring apps now on iOS is good. I think that's progress. I think they're doing a good job with that. But there's a lot of other things to nitpick. And of course, a lot of these things are temporary. So like with this app, Icro for micro.blog, frustrating waiting, kind of not knowing, like the uncertainty, like is the app going to be out? When's it going to be out? That's frustrating. But then the app is approved and then you can kind of put all that aside and you can say, whatever, it was annoying, but now we're done. We can link to the app. Everything's good. We can promote it and talk about it. And so some of these issues, they're frustrating, but they're also temporary. You know, you can kind of like put them behind you and move on. Right. So that's good too.
Okay, our second sponsor today is Linode. If you need a Linux box to host a website, a private Git repository, or maybe to serve as the backend for your iOS app, consider Linode Cloud Hosting. With Linode, you can get a server running in under a minute. They've been doing infrastructure as a service since 2003, and their plans start at the 1 gigabyte level for only $5 a month. Linode's 10 global data centers are equipped with industry-leading data center-grade SSDs, and their plans range from that low $5 a month plan up to higher memory plans that start at 16 gigabytes. All of this comes with the full control you expect from a VM, including support for Docker containers, encrypted disks, VPNs, etc. And they have great 24/7 friendly support, and that's open even on holidays. Now, if you're interested, and I think you should be, in trying out Linode, it's also important that you use this promo code, CoreInt2018. That will actually get you $20 credit. If you think about it, at that low $5 a month plan, that's equivalent to 4 free months to try out Linode, see how great it is to use their dashboard, manage your VPN, set things up however you want to, get everything working perfectly, try it out. And the easiest way to use that promo code is just to go to linode.com/coreint. Thanks so much to Linode for sponsoring the show.
Yeah, of course, I've been using Linode for years now. And just a week or two ago, something came up. Linode's pretty good about proactively letting you know about issues. I won't go into the details of this, but basically what happened is I decided I needed to call Linode and talk to somebody. I had never called them before. They have got great, you know, like email. They've got like a little system, you know, in their dashboard where you can go back and forth with their tech support people. They're really helpful. They've always been helpful in the past. This was something that I was like, I need to talk to somebody. Like, I can't wait around for email, even though they're quick to reply. And so I looked on their website, found their phone number and called them. They answered the phone. I didn't have to wait. Like, I was really impressed, basically, with their phone support. You know, we joked earlier with the Google Assistants, like, we don't like to call people. So, like, I also do not like to just randomly call people. And it was really nice that they picked up the phone. I talked to somebody. They resolved my issue. They have a nice system of, like, to confirm who you are, you know, you just kind of, like, type in the web thing. And they're like, okay, we know that's your account. We can fix the issue. Anyway, great, great support. I very rarely need to call these kind of people, these hosting providers, and I've never needed to call Leonard once in several years now, I guess, of using them. And it was really nice to just make a quick call, 5 minutes, everything's resolved, and be done. So great company. Really happy to have all my micro.blog servers hosted there. Thanks so much to Leno for being a longtime sponsor of Core Intuition. And you can learn more at leno.com/Corient.
Well, Manton, it's funny when you work for yourself, as I do, and as you do, and as some of our listeners do, and some of our listeners hope to do, you get to choose exactly what you work on from day to day and exactly what you don't work on. And this has been a couple of weeks for me where it's like, you know, we talked several weeks ago about like, I need to get a 4.1 out of Mars Edit. And I got working on that and it led me down this path where I was like, oh, you know what I always wanted to do with Mars Edit?
Oh, no.
I always wanted to, this is another aspect of this. Like, I have to admit, like, I am problematically vulnerable to customer emails sending me into like a tailspin and like going down a path that I probably shouldn't be going down at the moment. But I'm a curious person. When somebody emails me and they say something that they expect out of the app, and I agree with their expectation, it can really send me into like off onto a path of exploration. And as anybody who is either responsible for or participates in a relatively large sized code base, any kind of exploration can turn into an unexpected retrofit. It's kind of like, I think it's probably kind of like when, you know, contractors come into your home and they say, we're just going to replace this faucet. Oh, well, we tried to take the faucet out. It turns out like the wood is rotting behind. And then when we took out the wood to replace the wood, we noticed that all your pipes are corroded. And when we took out the pipes, that's when we noticed that there's an electrical short. So pretty soon you're like replacing all the plumbing and all of the electric wiring. And I kind of had a little bit of an experience like that with this combination of working on Mars Edit 4.1 and getting an email from somebody who innocently complained that Mars Edit was stripping the EXIF data from their images when they're uploading. And I know you have experience with this, Manton. So what you're thinking right now, I can read your mind over Skype. What you're thinking right now is, you shouldn't even care that it was stripping the EXIF data. Move on. Whatever. Like, that's good because it's protecting their privacy to remove the EXIF data. And I should have had more of those thoughts, but the thought I had was, oh, one of my dear beloved customers is having the EXIF data removed from their photos, and I need to look into this immediately.
Emergency.
Emergency. And I started looking into it, and I was like, you know, turns out this is hard to preserve. So what it came down to is Mars Edit does not strip out EXIF data if you just choose a file and say, I want to upload this. It does strip it out if you choose a file and say, I want to change the size of this image. And that makes sense because it turns out anybody who's used NSImage knows it's not really trivial to resize an image in AppKit from the beginning. It's not very trivial to get a new resized version of an image. And even if you figure out how to do it, it's furthermore not trivial at all to do that and preserve all the metadata on it. So I kind of took this is a perfect storm for me because I kind of took it as like, here's something that a specific customer is having a problem with. And this is something that's been bugging me for years because I knew it was there. I knew there was this issue. And what does any reasonable person do when faced with this challenge? Just decide to like stop using NSImage and switch to a cover class I'm calling RSImage that would just take care of everything that NSImage does, but in a cross-platform. This is where I also go wrong, man. And I say, well, since I'm already replacing NSImage, you know, one of the things that's been a hang-up for me about getting like Mars Edit for iOS has been UI image versus NS image. And if I'm going to go to all this trouble, so the long story short is if instead of using NS image, I wrap CG image, I can do a lot of fancy stuff, including preserving metadata, including preserving color spaces. All this stuff that like I've kind of known was a shortcoming of Mars Edit when it resizes images. So I do all this work. I basically spent like a week doing all this work, getting it working. And then I'm like, now I can make it work on iOS because that's also one of my goals, right? I want to make this thing available for Mars Edit for iOS when it eventually comes. So, okay, I get all that working. And then it's like the most comical thing. I get this all working. I'm like, aha, now I have the best. I'm like the best blog editor ever because I am the app that you can take and you can drop an image into it. I didn't even mention this, but it handles things like, you know, TIFF flags that reorient your image, rotate them left or right. It'll make all that right. Preserves the color space. It does so many right things. It's so right. And then I'm like, oh, it has the GPS data on right. my photo. And I'm uploading. Now I'm uploading the GPS data for people who are just trying to blog about like their kid's birthday. And now they're inadvertently publishing the exact geo-coordinates of their kid's birthday. Because I did this nice thing for one customer and made significant technological advances in my code base. And anyway, so then it just leads you down to the next step, which is like, okay, some people want metadata and some people don't. And there's still an argument here to be made for, and I almost made this argument to myself, and I almost satisfied myself that the right choice was throw out 2 weeks of work or whatever that I've done on this and now strip metadata with a vengeance. Like no longer let it be an accident of having used NS image, but let it be like a deliberate choice from using my RS image wrapper on CG image that says, no, thank you. I will not take that metadata. And I might still do that, but I still empathize with the people, minority as they may be, with the people who want to publish images with metadata. So anyway, long story short, Manton, I'm really ranting on this, but I kind of had a wasted 2 weeks, but this is one of those situations where you start digging into something. Like I said, like I took out the faucet, I took out the boards, I took out the plumbing, and I was like, whoa, this house is a mess. And I kept finding things. And I was like, ah, this is not good. And anyway, I have a situation now where I am sort of retrofitting the image management system of Mars Edit, just ostensibly to make it so that metadata gets preserved, but then also now to make sure that metadata doesn't get preserved.
Right.
And I decided I might add like a little in-between mode. I think I'm going to make this a user-facing setting on a default level and then on a per-image level where users can say, I want to strip the metadata, I want to keep the metadata, or I want to just strip the GPS location data. I think that's a pretty good compromise, but there's a little nagging simplicity voice in my head that says, just make it strip everything all the time.
You know, I think, so I have a few 2 cents on this. The first is just to laugh at the week and 2 weeks of like completely over-engineering the problem. And I say that both because I think it's kind of amusing, but also to point out how I had this similar problem and I did the opposite and it's actually hurting me. Mm-hmm. So like the long part of the story comes around to you probably did the right thing to take that time. Cause like as an example in Micro.blog, we have, you know, a few apps now and they all have similar, but not shared code between them to do this kind of image resizing and metadata stripping and stuff. So when I encountered these kind of issues, I probably should have taken a week to like rebuild the house like you did, and I didn't, and that's going to hurt me in the long run. So even though like I'm kind of joking about like over-engineering the problem, I think you're in a good position. Don't throw out that work. I think that work is worthwhile. And in micro.blog, I definitely took the approach of everything gets, pretty much everything gets resized down a little bit, scaled down, and everything gets all the metadata stripped out when you upload. This is from the iOS app and the Mac app. And there are some edge cases on the server where we're not always stripping things out, and I want to fix that. But from the iOS app, if you just attach a photo, it always strips everything out. And it's for exactly the reason you talked about. I was starting to become really paranoid when I thought about this, that someone might accidentally reveal their GPS location and they didn't know that was going to happen. And I think in the very early versions, there were certain cases where it didn't strip that out. And I just hadn't thought about it as a developer or as a user. Mm-hmm. And I think now with privacy being on everybody's minds, I think that we have to be conscious of this kind of stuff. And we should err on the side of getting rid of all this personal data that the user might not know. Because for most people that upload a photo are not going to think about this. They're just not going to even know. In a lot of cases, they're not even going to know that the GPS coordinates are in the photo at all.
Right.
Like who knows that? Who, like normal user, you know, nobody knows that. So I love the preference idea that you have. I think you should default to stripping everything.
Yeah.
But I like that there's a preference. Just default, strip everything. It's a change from the previous Mars edit, but it's a good change. Strip everything, but the user can easily go into preferences and toggle and say, oh no, just strip everything but GPS, or don't strip anything. I want all of my data preserved and I'll deal with it myself. That seems like a good approach to me. And the more that I hear you talk through this and the way you kind of preface the whole conversation with like, should you be working on bug fixes or 4.1? This is a 4.1 release.
Right.
This is a feature. This
it's
isn't
substantial,
like
substantial, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you're not working around a bug that a customer emailed you anymore. You're adding a major feature for privacy and control over images and better resizing and whatever else you've thrown into this, right? So, I think this is a good 4.1 release. Whatever you've got, maybe you add a couple other little things or anything kind of in the queue. But this is kind of a big change, and it seems like an important thing to kind of highlight and educate your user base about.
I think you're right. And I think it's one of these things where, you know, I'm always thinking like, what can I do from the desktop to differentiate myself from the web-based apps? And I was kind of surprised to learn, I haven't done a thorough survey, but like, I think generally speaking, most blog systems either just let all the metadata through or strip all the metadata out. Like, it's just kind of like one or the other.
Right.
As a rule, and unless you like have your own WordPress and you install plugins or whatever. It's one of those things where I have to remind myself as the developer of a blog editing app on the Mac, maybe someday on iOS, I do have the ability to give people these powers. And you know this, you're a blog app editor, you know, developer now yourself, and it can be a little dispiriting sometimes when you're like, well, what can I do to make things any better than the web interface? Well, you know, I might be thinking about this more than the collective contributor base to WordPress, or for that matter, to all the people who work on Tumblr or Blogger or everything else. And one of the like special powers of Mars Edit is it's a unified interface to all the blogs. And so I like when I can think of something that has a user-serving benefit that will apply to all of that user's blogs, regardless of where they are. And so like somebody who has somebody who says, hey, I have a custom WordPress blog that actually uses the GPS data on purpose to like automatically assign tags to things based on their location in the world, they can set that preference. And somebody who says, you know what, I'm a little bit like, you know, private, I don't ever want any of my metadata to go anywhere, they could use my setting to say, hey, I'm covered, and this is going to be stripped out. It's frustrating and hard to do this kind of work, and it's kind of seems a little thankless sometimes, because it's like, I appreciate you saying, hey, this sounds like a 4.1 feature. It's a little bit of a nuanced feature, but it is the kind of thing where when you're done with it, you say, hey, like I've said this before about, you know, a lot of my apps, but like you know, my crossword app and Mars Edit, there's things about these apps that are unparalleled in any other app in the world. And that's like one of the joys of working on your own software and publishing your own stuff is like, hey, I might not do everything everybody wants, but I did this one thing right. And, you know, it's taken now 2 weeks and counting to do this particular work, but I agree with you. It's not worth throwing out. Even if I were to decide to say, hey, forget it, we're not publishing any metadata. Well, it turns out that this change was important to make that happen too, because it gave me the sort of control over a process for stripping out the metadata. But there's also, you know, I'm always like working on this stuff where I'm like, am I just goofing off here? Or am I like, sort of like quietly working towards iOS versions of Mars Edit? Because what's really nice now is I made this new cover class, RS image. And then I found myself in this position where I was able to like move a bunch of like unit tests I have for handling images over to iOS. And I was like, flick the switch, add these to the iOS unit test case, you know, to my unit test target for iOS. And I was like, oh, well, first it failed because like, oh, I don't know what NS size is. So I go through and replace NS size with CG size. But all the stuff where it was like used to be a problem with NS image is now just like, yeah, cool, I know what RS image is. And it was kind of gratifying to do this work. And it did take a long time. And it's, you know, it's been taking some mental, you know, focus and energy. But then to like switch on pretty complicated like image transformation tests on iOS and just have them be like, yeah, we got that. We work. And mm-hmm. It's thanks to Apple having the CG, you know, the core graphics level stuff that I'm using. But it's kind of cool that like now I'm like, hey, I have this kind of cover class now that I can do fancy stuff on iOS and Mac. So not to tease Mars Edit for iOS, because it's not anywhere near to done, but anybody who's excited about that, maybe this is a little step in the right direction. I have a bunch of stuff in my, because, you know, I've compiled for 10 years now. I've compiled like Mars Edit stuff for iOS just as kind of like a, you know, sanity check. And there's a lot of stuff in there that has like if defs, like, nope, can't do this on iOS, fix this on iOS. And this is an example where it's kind of cool because I can go in now and I can say, actually, this can be done on iOS now. I can take out those if defs. So things are a little closer, even though, as I said, this all started from a kind of like weirdly specific bug about metadata for a Mac user. Now I have this like complete change to my source base, which is kind of cool to have, actually.
Yeah, it's nice when you have like a side effect like that. Like if you never do the iOS version of Mars Edit, none of this work was wasted. Like you can use all of this today, but it has this side effect of like, oh, it also works on iOS and it'll just make your life a little easier. It's one less thing you have to worry about if you ever sit down and say, you know what, I'm actually going to do this. I'm actually going to finish Mars Edit for iOS, get it done. Like you will not have to take that week in the middle of development and fix your image problem as part of that.
Right.
There'll be a bunch of other things to do, but like not the image,
right.
At least. And I like how this plays to Mars Edit's strengths too on the Mac, in that like Mars Edit, it's an easy to use blogging app that's compatible with a lot of servers, but it's also where you go if you're a power user and you need more control. So in the micro.blog app for Mac or iOS, I'm never going to add a preference for this. Like it's going to scale your images. It's going to strip them. Like the whole point of micro.blog is making blogging easier by adding the timeline and just removing a bunch of stuff, right? So I'm never going to have a bunch of preferences. I'm never going to have control over this for users. And I can do that because there are other options. So like if someone isn't happy with the fact that I have no preference for this, mm-hmm. they just use Mars Edit, right? Or they use something else, right? And like I see that all the time already with micro.blog customers who they mostly use the micro.blog app, but sometimes they use Mars Edit because they have like a bunch of images they have to upload or a bunch of posts they have to upload or, you know, edit or like need to do some batch stuff that's easier in like a full Mac editor. And so I like that. I like that Mars Edit has that role of like easy to use, post to your blog, but also has this power that most apps don't have. And right. That's good. That's a good thing. And so this preference is perfectly in line with that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, thanks for the encouragement to keep the preference. I think, you know, there's a little bit of like a nagging voice. It's like, ah, my preferences just keep getting more and more complex. But, you know, on the flip side, there is, I mean, the preferences are out of your way most of the time. And
yeah,
in that sense, like preferences can be really important to, like you say, a power user type of app.
Well, you have one decision I think you have to make with any preferences. You basically have, in this particular case, you kind of have three levels where you have global preferences that just apply everywhere. You have blog specific settings.
Yep.
And then in this case, you even mentioned there might be a per image upload setting for this. So mm-hmm. maybe the global default is strip everything. But as you're uploading something, you could say, oh, actually, it's okay. Like include the data. So like,
yeah,
you have some decisions to make there where like, I personally think it could be a global preference and you could be done. But like, maybe you want it to be a blog preference, or maybe you want the per image control. And so,
yeah, I've learned over the years that there's been this steady progression of preferences and so to be clear, I don't have a situation now where there are any preferences that exist both at a global level and a per blog level.
Mm-hmm.
It's like either things are global or they're per blog, and then some right. of those things can be overridden in the process of creating a specific post or image. Over the years, I've noticed that things move from the global to the per blog settings because there are reasonable arguments for having a preference one way on one blog and another way on another blog.
Yep.
So like, you know, it makes sense. Like if I'm going to make, if there were like, let's just say that Flickr gets a revival and they add support for, you know, something that makes it more suitable as like a blogging destination for Mars Edit. Well, I think a lot of people would like to have their location data on their Flickr posts because it's mm-hmm. kind of like something that, you know, there's a lot of services. This gets to the point that a lot of services have their own privacy controls on things. So you upload things as raw as you can, as information laden as you can, and you count on them to filter out the information. And Flickr is one of those where it would be like, yeah, I want to have all my information and I want people to be able to see this was taken with a Nikon, you know, mm-hmm. DSLR. And yeah. I want people to see this one was taken with an iPhone. So anyway, there's a lot of these settings. I think this one is suited to having a setting in the blog settings, and I'll probably leave it as a setting on a per image basis too, just because I could see people being like, hey, I took this picture in a national park and I don't care that people know I was at the Grand Canyon. It's just like, you know, if you're publishing to any social networking, sometimes you want to take the specific info off. But
yeah.
And with blog posts, you know, unlike like social media posts on some services, blog posts don't typically have a location setting on the blog post itself. So it's like, got to decide whether you want that to be on the image or not. I don't know. Anyway, it's mm-hmm. complicated, but
yeah.
I'm probably overthinking it, but I think that's sort of like my number one job role.
Mm-hmm. I think you have some options if you decide that, oh my gosh, this is taking weeks and I spent too much time on this. You could just remove one of the choices, really. You know, it's like yeah. you could ship it as is. You could add the preference here or there. I'm looking at the preferences now, and I agree that the blog specific settings are a really good place for this because you already have this section called media defaults where people can have a setting for always resizing images. So like that's yep. a natural place. I don't know how you make room in that window, but like that's a natural place for yeah. this setting to live. Like I could definitely see you just adding it there and being done. And then the bonus would be the per image
yeah.
Setting.
I think I'll do something like that. And, you know, there's sort of a natural corollary for those settings in the UI when you're inserting an image is a little bit cumbersome, but it's already crowded enough. It could probably take another mm-hmm. thing in there.
I see it. Yeah.
Yeah. So
cool. Well, good luck wrapping this up. I think it will be worth the time. And it's also a good discussion, I think, for us to have. And like I said, I mean, I think you and I share many of these same issues now, and our apps are different, so they'll take mm-hmm. different approaches. But like everyone that is working on these kind of apps should be thinking about this. And I mean, really, it's so important that I should probably write up kind of a guide for micro.blog third-party developers to, you know, like this is what I recommend you do. Because
Right.
People kind of like every app can do something slightly different, but like I think over time people are going to have an expectation of kind of like what the default is, and they shouldn't be too surprised when it differs.
Yeah, and from a point of view of a blog hosting system, you might even consider, I know this is just making things more complex, you might even consider whether developers have the option of conveying to you what the user's intentions are. Yeah. I don't know if, I mean, that's complicated because they should just strip it out probably themselves if they, but like, I'm thinking about the situation where like a nuanced, like highfalutin photo blogging app wants to use micro.blog. And it's for users who definitely want to share all their like DSLR aperture numbers and stuff somehow. They might want to say, hey, trust me, these users want the metadata. Whereas like as a default, you might want to strip the metadata.
Right. That's an interesting question. And it probably gets back to like, I think there probably shouldn't, like micro.blog should probably just strip everything. And on, yeah. actually on the server, it mostly strips everything anyway. So it's like it's stripped on the iOS app, and then just in case, it's also stripped in some cases on the server, and it's not completely universal, which is what I discovered recently, and that needs to be fixed. But I don't know. It's a good question.
Something I
should think about. Yeah.
All right. Well, we have plenty to think about, Manton. It's been great chatting with you. Of course, as always, folks, if you want to get in touch with us, frankly, one of the best ways is to come join us at chat.coreint.org. Not only do you get to get in direct contact with us, we had a great, gratifying bit of feedback from a new member of our community on the Core Intuition Slack, and they were just like really grateful for the fact that not only, in addition to doing the podcast, that we, you know, engage with our community. It is a fun way to make all of us seem a little more real to each other. Everybody's welcome to join us there. And of course, if you want to get in touch privately, you can also email us feedback@coreint.org. And we're on some social networks and stuff, but anyway, we don't need to talk about that, right?
Everybody join micro.blog. Everybody.
Everybody dance now.
All right, we'll talk to you next time.